haircut. I rubbed my eyes with my good hand. Yeah, I said. And you tell me when you know something. Murph, if this is something from the Never Never, it's going to be out of your, I almost said, league. Jurisdiction. She shrugged. If it came into my town and hurt someone I'm responsible for protecting, I want to make an answer for that. She closed her eyes. Same as you. Besides, you promised. Well, she had me there. Yeah, okay, Murph. When I find something out, I'll call. All right, she said. She curled up in the corner of the couch again, heavy eyes closing. She leaned her head back, baring the lines of her throat. After a moment, she asked, Have you heard from Susan? I shook my head. No. But her articles are still coming into the Arcane. She's all right. I nodded. I guess so. Have you found anything that'll help her yet? I sighed and shook my head. No, not yet. It's like pounding my head against a wall. She halfway smiled. With your head, the wall breaks first. You're the most stubborn man I ever met. You say the sweetest things. Murphy nodded. You're a good man, Harry. If anyone can help her, it's you. I looked down so she wouldn't see the tears that made my eyes swim a little and started putting the file back together. Thanks, Murph. That means a lot to me. She didn't answer. I looked up and saw that her mouth had fallen slightly open and her body was totally relaxed, a cheek resting on the arm of the couch. Murph? I asked. She didn't stir. I got up and left the file on the chair. I found a blanket and draped it lightly over her, tucking it in around her. She made a soft sound in the back of her throat and nuzzled her cheek closer to the couch. Sleep well, Murph, I said. Then I headed for the door. I locked what I could behind me, made my way back to the Beetle, and drove toward home. I ached everywhere. Not from sore muscles, but from simple exhaustion. My wounded hand felt like a big throbbing knot of cramping muscle doused in gasoline and set on fire. I hurt even more on the inside. Poor Murph had been torn up badly. She was terrified of the things she might have to face, but that made her no less determined to face them. That was courage, and more than I had. I, at least, was sure I could hit back if one of the monsters came after me. Murphy didn't have any such certainty. Murphy was my friend. She'd saved my life before. We'd fought side by side. She needed my help again. She had to face her fear. I understood that. She needed me to help make it happen, but I didn't have to like it. In her condition, she would have been extra vulnerable to any kind of attack like the one by Kravos the year before. And if she got hit again before she had had a chance to piece herself back together, it might not simply wound her. It might break her entirely. I wasn't sure I could live with myself if that happened. Damn it, I muttered. So help me, Murph. I'm going to make sure you come out of this okay. I shoved my worries about Murphy to the back of my mind. The best way to protect her would be to focus on this case, to get cracking. But my brain felt like something had crawled into it and died. The only cracking it was going to be doing was the kind that would land me in a rubber room and a sleeveless coat. I wanted food, sleep, a shower. If I didn't take some time to put myself back together, I might walk right into something that would kill me and not notice it until it was too late. I drove back to my apartment, which is the basement of a rooming house more than a century old. I parked the Beetle outside and got my rod and staff out of the car to take with me. It wasn't much of a walk between my apartment and the car, but I'd been accosted before. Vampires can be really inconsiderate that way. I thumped down the stairs to my apartment, unlocked the door, and murmured the phrase that would disarm the wards long enough to get me inside. I slipped in, and my instincts screamed at me that I was not alone. I lifted the blasting rod, gathered my power, and sending it humming through the focus so that a tip burst into brilliant crimson light that flooded my apartment. And then there she was, a slender woman standing by my cold fireplace, all graceful curves and poised reserve. She wore a pair of blue jeans over long, coltish legs with a simple scarlet cotton T-shirt. A silver pentacle hung outside the shirt, resting on the curve of her modest breasts, and it gleamed in the light from my readied blasting rod. Her skin was pale, like the inner bark of an oak, the living part of the tree. Her hair the brown gold of ripe wheat, her eyes the gray of storm clouds. Her fine mouth twitched first into a smile, then into a frown, and she lifted elegant long-fingered hands to show me empty palms. "I let myself in," she murmured. "I hope you don't mind. You should change your wards more often." I lowered the blasting rod, too stunned to speak, my heart lurching in my chest. She lowered her hands and closed the distance between us. She lifted herself onto her toes, but she was tall enough that it wasn't much of an effort for her to kiss my cheek. She smelled like wildflowers and sun-drenched summer afternoons. She drew back enough to focus on my face and my eyes, her own expression gentle and concerned. "Hello, Harry," and I said, in a bare whisper, fighting through the shock. "Hello, Elaine." Chapter 8. Elaine walked past me, making a circuit around my apartment. It wasn't much of a tour. The place consisted of a living room and a tiny bedroom. The kitchen is pretty much just an alcove with a sink and a fridge. The floor is smooth gray stone, but I'd covered a lot of it with a few dozen rugs. My furniture is all second-hand and comfortable. It doesn't even come close to matching. Bookshelves fill up most of the wall space, and where they don't, I have several tapestries, plus a Star Wars movie poster Billy gave me for Christmas. It's the old poster, the one with Princess Leia clinging to Luke's leg. Anyway, that was my apartment on a normal day. Lately, it had suffered from disrepair. It didn't smell so great, and pizza boxes and empty Coke cans had overflowed the trash can and spilled over a significant portion of the kitchen floor. You could barely walk without stepping on clothing that needed to be washed. My furniture was covered with scribbled-on papers and discarded pens and pencils. Elaine walked through it all like a Red Cross worker through a war zone and shook her head. "I know you weren't expecting me, Harry, but I didn't think I'd be overdressed. You live in this?" "Elaine," I choked out, "you're alive." A little less of a compliment than I would have hoped for, but I guess it could have been worse. She regarded me from near the kitchen. "I'm alive, Harry." Her face flickered with a trace of apprehension. "How are you feeling?" I lowered myself onto the couch, papers crunching beneath me. I released the power held ready to strike, and the glowing tip of the blasting rod went out, leaving the apartment in darkness. I kept staring at her after-image on my vision. "Shocked," I said finally. "This isn't happening. Hell's bells, this has got to be some sort of trick." "No, it's me. If I was something out of the Never Never, could I have crossed your threshold uninvited? Do you know anyone else who knows how you set up your wards?" "Anyone could figure it out eventually," I said. "All right. Does anyone else know that you failed your driver's test 5 times in 1 week? Or that you sprained your shoulder trying to impress me going out for football our freshman year? That we soul-gazed on our first night together? I think I can still remember our locker combination, if you like." "My God, Elaine!" I shook my head. "Elaine! Alive!" My brain could not wrap itself around the idea. "Why didn't you contact me?" I saw her dimly lean against the wall. She was quiet for a while, as though she had to shape her words carefully. "At first, because I didn't even know if you had survived. And after that," she shook her head, "I wasn't sure I wanted to. Wasn't sure you'd want me to. So much happened." My shock and disbelief faded before a sudden aching pain and an old, old anger. "That's putting it mildly," I said. "You tried to destroy me." "No," she said. "God, no, Harry, you don't understand. I never wanted that." My voice gained a hard edge. "Which is why you hit me with that binding? Why you held me down while Justin tried to destroy me?"
"He never wanted you dead."
"No, he just wanted to break into my head, wanted to control me, make me into some kind of a... Words failed me in the face of my frustration.
"Thrall," she said quietly.
"He'd have wrapped you in enough spells to guarantee your loyalty, to make you his thrall." "And that's worse than dead, and you helped him." Her voice crackled with anger of its own. Yes, Harry, I helped him. That's what thralls do. My rising ire abruptly quieted. What? What are you saying?
I saw her dim shape bow its head. Justin caught me about 2 weeks before he sent that demon to capture you. That day I stayed home sick, remember? By the time you got home from school, he had me. I tried to fight him, but I was a child. I didn't have enough experience to resist him. And after he'd enthralled me, I didn't see why I should fight anymore. I stared at her for a long minute. So you're telling me that you didn't have any choice, I breathed. He forced you to do it. He made you help him. Yes. Why the hell should I believe you? I don't expect you to. I rose and paced back and forth restlessly. I can't believe you're trying to tell me that the devil made you do it. Do you have any idea how lame that excuse sounds? Elaine watched me carefully, her gray eyes pensive and sad. It wasn't an excuse, Harry. Nothing can excuse the kind of pain I put you through. I stopped and frowned at her. Then why are you telling me? Because it needs to be said, she murmured. Because that's what happened. You deserve to know. It was quiet for a long time, then I said. He really had enthralled you? Elaine shivered and nodded. What was it like? She fretted at her lower lip. I didn't know it was happening. Not at the time. I didn't have the ability to think clearly. Justin told me that you just needed to be shown what to do, and that if I would hold you still long enough to let him explain things to you, it would all work out. I believed him, trusted him. She shook her head. I never wanted to hurt you, Harry. Never. I'm sorry. I sat down and rubbed my face with my hands, my emotions running high and out of control again. Without the anger to support me, all that was left inside was pain. I thought I'd gotten over Elaine's loss, her betrayal. I thought I'd forgotten it and moved on. I was wrong. The wounds burst open again, as painful as they'd ever been, maybe more so. I had to fight to control my breathing, my tone. I had loved her. I wanted very badly to believe her. I looked for you, I said quietly, in fire and water. I had spirits combing the earth for any trace of you, hoping that you'd survived. She pushed away from the wall and walked to the fireplace. I heard her putting in wood. Then she murmured something soft and low. Flame licked up over the logs easily, smoothly, low and blue, then settled into a dark golden light. I watched her profile as she stared down at the fire. I got out of the house before you and Justin were finished, she said finally. His spells had begun to unravel, and I was struggling against them, confused, terrified. I must have run. I don't even remember doing it. But where have you been? I asked. Elaine, I've looked for you for years. Years. Where you couldn't have found me, Harry. You or anyone else. I found sanctuary, a place to hide. But there was a price, and that's why I'm here. She looked up at me, and though her features were calm and smooth, I could see the fear in her eyes, hearing it coloring her voice. I'm in trouble. My answer came out at once. For me, chivalry isn't dead. It's an involuntary reflex. It could have been any woman asking for help, and I'd have said the same thing. It might have taken me a second or two longer, but I would have. For Elaine, there was no need to think about it for even that long. I'll help. Her shoulders sagged, and she nodded, pressing her lips together and bowing her head. Thank you, Harry. I hate doing this. I hate bringing this to you after all this time, but I don't know where else to turn. No, I said. It's all right, really. What's going on? Why do you think you're in trouble? What do you mean you're paying a price? It's complicated, she said. But the short version is that I was granted asylum by the summer court of the Shi. My stomach dropped about 20 feet. I built up a debt to Titania, the summer queen, in exchange for her protection, and now it's time to pay it off. She took a deep breath. There's been a murder within the realms of the Shi. I rubbed my eyes. And Titania wants you to be her emissary. She wants you to find the killer and prove that the Winter Court is to blame. She told you that you would be contacted tonight by Mab's emissary, but she didn't tell you who it was going to be. Elaine's eyes widened in shock, and she fell silent. We stared at one another for a long time before she whispered, "Stars and stones." She pushed her hair back from her face with one hand, in what I knew to be a nervous gesture, even if it didn't look it. "Harry, if I don't succeed, if I don't fulfill my debt to her, it's going to be very bad for me." "Oh, boy," I muttered. "Tell me about it." "Mab's more or less got me over the same barrel." Elaine swore quietly. "What are we going to do?" I said. She looked at me expectantly. I scowled. I'm thinking. She rose and took a few long-legged strides across the living room and back, agitated. "There must be something, some way out of this. God, sometimes their sense of humor makes me sick. Mab and Titania are laughing right now." If I'd had the energy, I'd have been pacing too. I closed my eyes and tried to think. If I didn't succeed on Mab's behalf, she wouldn't grant rites of passage to the council. The council would judge that I'd failed my trial, and they'd wrap me up and deliver me to the vampires. I didn't know the specifics of Elaine's situation, but I doubt she had a deal that was any less fatal. My head hurt. Elaine continued pacing, exasperated. "Come on, Harry. What are you thinking?" "I'm thinking that if this dilemma grows any more horns, I'm going to shoot it and put it up on the wall." "I know this will never sink into your head, but this isn't the time for jokes. We need to come up with something." "Okay, I've got it," I said. "Get your stuff and come with me." Elaine reached back into the shadows beside the fireplace and withdrew a slender staff of pale wood carved with swirling, abstract shapes. "Where are we going?" I pushed myself up. "To talk to the council and get their help." Elaine lifted her eyebrows. "Don't take this the wrong way, Harry, but are you crazy?" "Hear me out." She pressed her lips together, gave me a quick nod. "It's simple. We're in way over our heads. We need help. You've got to come out to the council in any case." "Says who?" "Oh, come on. You're human, Elaine, and a wizard. That's what is really important to them. They'll side with us against the fairies, help us figure a way out of this mess." Elaine twitched at my use of the word, flicking a look around as if by reflex. "That doesn't sound like the council I've heard of." "Could be you've got a skewed point of view," I said. Elaine nodded. "Could be. The council I've heard of nearly executed you for defending yourself against Justin." "Well, yeah, but they put you on probation under threat of summary execution, and you all but had to kill yourself to get cleared." Well, I was all but killing myself anyway. I mean, I didn't do it so that the council would..." She shook her head. "God, Harry, you just can't see it, can you? The council doesn't care about you. They don't want to protect you. They will only put up with you as long as you toe the line and don't become an inconvenience." "I'm already inconvenient." "A liability, then," Elaine said. "Look, some of the council have their heads up their rear ends, sure, but there are good people there, too." Elaine folded her arms and shook her head. "And how many of those good people don't want a thing to do with the council?" "Elaine." "No, Harry, I mean it. I don't want anything to do with them. I've lived this long without the council's so-called protection. I think I can muddle through a little longer." "Elaine, when they find out about you, it needs to be from you. If you come forward, it's going to cut down on any uneasiness or suspicion they might feel." "Suspicion?" Elaine exclaimed. "Harry, I'm not a criminal." "You're just asking for trouble, Elaine." "And how are they going to find out about me, hmm? Were you planning on running off to tattle?" "Of course not," I said. But I was thinking how much trouble I was going to be in if one of the warders heard I was associating with someone who might be a violator of the first law, and one of Justin DuMorne's apprentices at that. With the cloud of disfavor I was already under, adding that kind of suspicion to it might be enough to sink me, regardless of how the investigation turned out. Do I have a great life or what? "I won't say anything," I said finally. "It has to be your choice, Elaine. But please believe me. Trust me. I have friends in the council, too. They'll help." Elaine's expression softened and became less certain. "You're sure?" "Yeah," I said. Cross my heart. She leaned on her oddly curved staff and frowned. She was opening her mouth to speak when my reinforced door rattled under the rapping of a heavy fist.
Dresden! Morgan growled from the other side of the door. Open up, traitor! There are questions I need you to answer!
Chapter 9. Elaine shot me a wide-eyed look and mouthed the word, Council. I nodded and pointed to my staff, in the corner along with my sword cane. Elaine picked it up without a word and tossed it to me. Then she moved silently through the door of my darkened bedroom and vanished inside. The door rattled again.
Dresden! Morgan growled. I know you're in there! Open the door!
I swung it open before I could go on. Or you'll huff and you'll puff and so on. Morgan glowered at me, tall, sour, and dour as ever. He'd traded his robes and cloak for dark slacks, a gray silk shirt, and a sport coat. He carried a golf bag on one shoulder, and most people wouldn't have noticed the hilt of a sword nestled among the golf clubs. He leaned forward, cool eyes looking past me into my apartment.
Dresden, am I interrupting something?
Well, I was going to settle down with a porn video and a bottle of baby oil, but I really don't have enough for two. Morgan's expression twisted in revulsion, and I felt an absurd little burst of vindictive satisfaction.
You disgust me, Dresden.
Yeah, I'm bad. I'm a bad, bad man. I'm glad we got that settled. Goodbye, Morgan. I started to shut my door in his face. He slammed his palm against it. Morgan was a lot stronger than me. The door stayed open. I'm not finished, Dresden.
I am. It's been one hell of a day. If you've got something to say, say it. Morgan's mouth said in a hard smile. Normally, I appreciate that kind of directness. Not with you.
Gee, you don't appreciate me. I'll cry myself to sleep. Morgan stroked his thumb over the strap to the golf bag.
I want to know how it is, Dresden, that Mab just happened to come to you about this problem. The one thing that can preserve your status with the Council, and it just happened to fall to you.
Clean living, I said. Plus my Mondo wheels and killer bachelor pad. Morgan looked at me with flat eyes.
You think you're funny?
Oh, I know I'm funny. Unappreciated, but funny. Morgan shook his head.
Do you know what I think, Dresden?
You think? Morgan didn't smile. Like I said, underappreciated.
I think you've planned all of this. I think you're in with the vampires and the Winter Court. I think this is part of a deeper scheme.
I just stared at him. I tried not to laugh. I really did.
Well, maybe I didn't try all that hard.
The laughter must have gotten to Morgan. He balled up his fist and slammed a stiff jab into my belly that took the wind out of my sails and dropped me half to my knees.
No, he said. You aren't going to laugh this off, traitor.
He stepped into my apartment. The threshold didn't make him blink. The wards I had up caught him 6 inches later, but they weren't designed to be too much of an impediment to human beings. Morgan grunted, spoke in a harsh word in a guttural tongue, maybe old German, and slashed his hand in front of him. The air hissed and popped with static electricity, sparks flashing from his fingertips. He shook his fingers briefly and then walked in. He looked around the place and shook his head again.
Dresden, you might not be a bad person, all in all, but I think you're compromised. If you aren't working with the Red Court, then I'm certain that they're using you. Either way, the threat to the Council is the same. And it's best removed by removing you.
I tried to suck in a breath and finally managed to say, what the hell are you talking about?
Susan Rodriguez, Morgan said. Your lover, the vampire.
Anger made bright lights flash behind my eyes.
She's not a vampire, I snarled.
They turned her, Dresden. No one goes back. That's all there is to it.
They haven't. She's not, Morgan shrugged. That's what you'd say if she'd addicted you to the venom. You'd say or do just about anything for them by now.
I looked up at him, teeth bared.
Get the fuck out of my house.
He walked over to the fireplace and picked up a dust-covered gift card I'd left sitting on the mantel. He read it and snorted. Then he picked up a picture I had of Susan.
Pretty, he said. But that's easy to come by. Odds are she was their pawn from the first day she met you.
I clenched my hands into fists.
You shut your mouth, I said. You just shut your mouth about her. That's not how it was. You're a fool, Dresden. A young fool. Do you really think that a normal, mortal woman would want anything to do with you or your life? You can't accept that she was just a tool, one of their whores. I spun to the corner, letting go of my staff, and picked up my sword cane. I drew the blade free with a steely rasp and turned toward Morgan. He saw it coming and had already drawn the bright silver blade of the warden's from the golf bag. Every tired, aching, angry bone in my body wanted to lunge at him. I'm not heavy with muscle, but I'm not slow, and I've got arms and legs miles long. My lunge is quick, and I can do it from a long way back. Morgan was a seasoned soldier, but in such close quarters it would have been a question of reflexes, advantage to the guy with the sword weighed in ounces instead of stones. In that moment, I was sure I could have killed him. He might have taken me with him, but I could have done it. And I wanted to. Badly. Not in any sort of intellectual sense, but in the part of the brain that does all the thinking after the fact. My temper had frayed to bloody tatters, and I wanted to vent it on Morgan. But a thought snuck in past the testosterone and spoiled my rage. I stopped myself, shaking, and with my knuckles white on my sword cane, drew myself up straight, and I said very quietly, "That's number three." Morgan's brow furrowed, and he stared at me, his own weapon steadily extended toward me.
"What are you talking about, Dresden?"
"The third plan. The Merlin's ace in the hole. He sent you here to pick a fight with me, with my door still standing open. There's another warder outside, listening, isn't there? A witness so that you can have a clean kill, hand the body over to the vampires. End of problem, right?"
Morgan's eyes widened. He stammered over the first word.
I don't know what you're talking about." I picked up the sheath half of the sword cane and slipped the blade back into it.
"Sure you don't. Get out, Morgan. Unless you prefer to stab an unarmed man who isn't offering you violence."
Morgan stared at me for a moment more. Then he shoved the sword cane back into the golf bag, swung it onto his shoulder, and headed for the door. He was almost out when there was a clunk from my bedroom. I shot a look at the doorway. Morgan stopped. He looked at me and then at my bedroom, something ugly sparkling in his gaze.
"Who is in the bedroom, Dresden? The vampire girl, perhaps?"
"No one," I said. "Get out."
"We'll see,"
Morgan said. He turned and walked to my bedroom door, one hand still on the sword.
"You and those who consort with your like will be brought to task very soon. I'm looking forward to it."
My heart started pounding again. If Morgan found Elaine, there was about a million things that could happen, and none of them were good. There seemed little I could do, though. I couldn't warn her. I couldn't think of a way to get Morgan out of my apartment any faster. Morgan peered through the doorway and looked around, then abruptly let out a hoarse cry and jumped back. At the same time, there was a harsh feline yowl, and Mister, my bobtailed gray cat, came zooming out of the bedroom. He darted between Morgan's legs and then streaked past him, out of the apartment and up the stairs into the summer evening.
"Gosh, Morgan," I said. "My cat might be a dangerous subversive. Maybe you'd better interrogate him."
Morgan straightened, his face slightly red. He coughed and then stalked to the door.
"The senior council members wish me to tell you that they will be nearby, but they will not interfere in this trial or aid you in any way."
He took a business card out of his shirt pocket and let it fall to the floor.
"That's the contact number for the senior counsel. Use it when you have failed the trial."
"Don't let the door hit you on the brain on the way out," I responded. Morgan glared at me as he left. He slammed the door behind him and stomped up the stairs. I started trembling maybe a half a minute after he left. Reaction to the stress. At least I hadn't done it in front of him. I turned around, leaned back against the door with my eyes closed, and folded my arms over my chest. It was easier not to feel myself shaking that way. Another minute or two passed before I heard Elaine move quietly out of my bedroom. The fire popped and crackled.
"Are they gone?"
Elaine asked. Her voice was very carefully steady.
"Yeah, though I wouldn't put it past them to watch my place."
I felt her finger touch my shoulder.
"You're shaking, Harry."
"I'll be all right."
"You could have killed him," Elaine said.
"When you drew first."
"Yeah."
"Was he really setting you up like he said?" I looked at her. Her expression was worried.
"Yeah," I said.
"God, Harry." She shook her head.
That's way past paranoia. And you want me to give myself to those people? I covered her hand with mine.
Not to them, I said. Not everybody on the council is like that.
She looked at my eyes for a moment. Then she carefully drew her hand out from under mine. No. I'm not going to make myself vulnerable to men like that. Not again. Elaine, I protested. She shook her head. I'm leaving, Harry. She brushed her hair back from her face. Are you going to tell them? I took a deep breath. If the wardens found out that Elaine was still alive and avoiding them, there would be a literal witch hunt. The wardens weren't exactly known for their tolerance and understanding. Morgan was walking, talking proof of that. Anyone who helped shield her from the wardens would get the same treatment. Didn't I already have enough problems?
No, I said. Of course not.
Elaine gave me a strained smile.
Thank you, Harry.
She lifted her staff closer to her, holding it with both hands. Can you get the door for me?
They're going to be out there watching.
I'll veil. They won't see me.
They're good.
She shrugged and said without emphasis, I'm better. I've had practice. I shook my head.
What are we going to do about the fairies?
I don't know, she said. I'll be in touch.
How can I contact you?
She nodded toward the door. I opened it. She stepped up beside me and kissed my cheek again, her lips warm. You're the one with the office and the answering service. I'll contact you. Then she stepped to the door, murmuring quietly under her breath. There was a glitter of sudden silver light around her that made me blink. When I opened my eyes, she was gone. I left the door open for a moment, and it was just as well that I did. Mister came padding back down the stairs a moment later and looked at me with a plaintive meow. He prowled back into the apartment, curling around my legs and purred like a diesel engine. Mister is 30 pounds or so of tomcat. I figure one of his parents must have been a saber-toothed tiger.
Good timing, by the way, I told him, and shut the door, locking it.
I took in the dim, warm firelight of the room. My cheek still tingled where Elaine had kissed it. I could smell her lingering perfume, and it brought with it a pang of almost tangible memories, a flood of things I thought I'd forgotten. It made me feel old and tired and very alone. I walked to the mantel and straightened a card Susan had sent me the previous Christmas. I looked at her picture next to the card. She'd been in a park that weekend, wearing a blue tank top and cut-off shorts. Her teeth were impossibly white against her darkly tanned skin and coal-black hair. I had taken the picture while she was laughing, and her dark eyes shone. I shook my head.
I am tired, mister, I said. I am ridiculously tired.
Mister meowed at me.
Well, resting would be the sane thing to do, but who am I to throw stones, right? I mean, I'm talking to my cat.
I scratched in my beard and nodded to myself. Just a minute on the couch, then to work. I remember sitting down on the couch, and after that, everything went blissfully blank. Which was just as well. The next day, things got complicated. Chapter 10. I wasn't too tired to dream. Evidently, my subconscious, we've met, and he's kind of a jerk, had something on his mind. Because the dream was a variation on the theme that had taken up most of my sleeping hours since I'd last seen Susan. The dream began with a kiss. Susan has a gorgeous mouth. Not too thin, not too full, always soft, always warm. When she kissed me, it was like the world went away. Nothing mattered but the touch of her lips on mine. I kissed the dream Susan, and she melted against me with a soft sound, the length of her body pliant, eager. Her fingers reached up and trailed over my chest, nails lightly raking. I leaned back from the kiss after a long moment, and my eyes felt almost too heavy to open. My lips quivered and tingled with sensation, a feeling that begged for more kisses to make it cease. She looked up at me, dark eyes smoldering. Her hair had been pulled back into a long silken tail and fell between her shoulder blades. It had grown longer in the dreams, her lovely, aquiline face tilted up toward mine. "Are you all right?" I asked her. I always did. And as always, she gave me a small, sad smile and did not answer.
I bit my lip. I'm still looking. I haven't given up. She shook her head and drew back from me. I had the presence of mind to look around. A dark alley this time, with the heavy, pounding music of a dance club making the nearest wall vibrate. Susan wore dark tights and a sleeveless blouse, and my black leather duster had been draped over her shoulders and fell to brush her feet. She looked at me intently and then turned toward the entrance to the club. "Wait," I said. She walked to the door and turned back to me, extending her hand. The door opened, and a dim, reddish light flooded out over her, doing odd things to the shadows over her face. Her dark eyes grew larger. No, that wasn't right. The black of her pupils simply expanded until the whites were gone, until there was nothing but darkness where her eyes should have been. They were vampire eyes, huge and inhuman. "I can't," I said. "We can't go in there, Susan." Her features grew frustrated, angry. She extended her hand to me again, more forcefully. Hands came out of the darkness in the doorway, slim, pale, androgynous. They slipped over Susan, slowly, caressingly, tugging at her clothing, her hair. Her eyes fluttered closed for a moment, her body growing stiff before her weight shifted slowly toward the doorway. Longing shot through me, sudden, mindless, and sharp as a scalpel's blade. Hunger, a simple and nearly violent need to touch, to be touched, followed it into me, and I suddenly could not think. "Don't," I said, and I stepped toward her. I felt her hand take mine. I felt her press herself to me with another moan, and her lips, her mouth, devoured mine with ravenous kisses, kisses I answered with my own. Harder and more demanding as my doubts faded. I felt it when her kiss turned poisonous, when the sudden narcotic numbness swept through my mouth and began to spread through my body. It didn't make any difference. I kissed her, tore at her clothes, and she tore at mine. The hands helped, but I didn't pay any attention to them anymore. They were an unimportant background sensation in comparison to Susan's mouth, her hands, her skin velvet and warm beneath my fingers. There was no romance, nothing but need, animal, carnal. I pushed her against the wall in the dim scarlet light, and she wrapped herself around me, frantic, her body urging me on. I pressed into her, sudden sensation of silk and honey, and had to fight for control, throwing my head back. She quivered then, and as always, she struck. Her mouth closed on my throat, a flash of heat and agony that melted into a narcotic bliss like that of her kiss, but more complete. Languid delight spread through me, and I felt my body reacting, all traces of control gone, thrusting against her, into her. The motion slowly died as sheer, quivering ecstasy spread through me. I began to lose control of my limbs, muscles turning to gelatin. I sank slowly to the floor. Susan rode me down, her mouth hot and eager on my throat, her body, her hips moving now, taking over the rhythm. The pleasure of the venom melted my thoughts, and they slid free of my flesh, floating over the ground. I looked down on my body, beneath Susan, pale and still on the floor, eyes empty. I saw the change take her. I saw her body twist and buck, saw her skin split and rip open. I saw something dark and horrible tear its way out, all gaping dark eyes and slippery black hide. Blood, my blood, smeared its mouth. The creature froze in shock, staring down at my corpse. And as I began to drift away, the creature threw back its head, its body rubbery and sinuous as a snake's, and let out an inhuman, screeching yowl full of rage, pain, and need. I jolted up out of sleep with a short cry, my skin sheathed in a cold sweat, my muscles aching and stiff. I panted for a moment, looking around my apartment. My lips tingled with remembered kisses, my skin with dreamed caresses. I forced myself to my feet with a groan and staggered toward my shower. There were times when it was just as well that I disconnected the water heater to head off magically inspired mishaps. It made bathing sheer torture in the winter, but sometimes there's no substitute for a cold shower.
I stripped and stood under chilly water for a while, shaking. Not necessarily from cold, either. I shook with a lot of things. First, with raw and mindless lust. The shower took the edge off of that for a few moments. Don't get me wrong, I didn't have any particular death sex fixation, but I had been used to a certain amount of friendly tension relieving with Susan. Her absence had killed that for me, completely, except for rare moments during the damn dreams when my hormones came raging back to the front of my thoughts again, as though making up for lost time. Second, I trembled with fear. My nightmares might be one part lusty dream, but they were also a warning. Susan's curse could kill me and destroy her. I couldn't forget that. And finally, I shook with guilt. If I hadn't let her down, maybe she wouldn't be in this mess. She was gone, and I didn't have the vaguest idea where she was. I should be doing more. I stuck my head in the water and shoved these thoughts away, washing myself off with a ton of soap and the last shampoo in the bottle. I scrubbed at my beard and finally reached out and got my straight razor, then spent a few minutes and a lot of care removing it. Dark, wiry black hair fell in clumps to the shower floor, and my face tingled as it breathed its first air for a couple of months. But it felt good, and as I went through the routine of grooming, my thoughts cleared. I dug some clean clothes out of my closet, padded out to the living room, and pulled back the rug that covered the trap door leading to the sub-basement. I swung the door open, lit a candle, and descended the stepladder staircase into my lab. My lab, in contrast to the havoc upstairs, looked like something run by a particularly anal-retentive military clerk. A long table ran down the middle of the room, between a pair of other tables, one on either wall, leaving only narrow walkways. White steel wire shelves on the walls held a host of magical components I used in research. They resided in a variety of jars, bottles, boxes, and plastic containers, most with labels listing the contents, how much was left, and when I had acquired the item. The tables were clean except for stacks of notes, a jar of pens and pencils, and myriad candles. I lit a few of them and walked down to the other side of the lab, checking the copper summoning circle set into the floor and making sure that nothing lay across it. You never know when a magic circle would come in handy. One area of the lab that had retained the casual chaos that had been its major theme before I'd taken up nearly full residence last year. One shelf, still battered old wood, hadn't been changed or updated. Candle holders, covered in multiple shades of melted wax that had spilled down over them, sat on either side of the shelf. Between them was a scattering of various articles, a number of battered paperback romances, several Victoria's Secret catalogs, a scarlet scrap of silk ribbon that had been tied into a bow on a naked young woman named Justine, one bracelet from a broken set of handcuffs, and a bleached old human skull. "Bob, wake up," I said, lighting the candles. "I need to pick your brain." Lights, orange and nebulous, kindled deep in the shadows of the skull's eye sockets. The skull quivered a little bit on its shelf and then stretched its toothy mouth open in an approximation of a yawn.
"So, was the kid all right? Was there some portent-type action going on?"
"Rain of toads," I said.
"Real ones?"
"Yeah." "Ouch," said Bob the skull. Bob wasn't really a skull. The skull was just a vessel for the spirit of intellect that resided inside and helped me keep track of the constantly evolving metaphysical laws that govern the use of magic. But Bob the Skull is a lot easier to say than Bob the Spirit of Intellect and Lab Assistant. I nodded, breaking out my Bunsen burners and beakers. "Tell me about it. Look, Bob, I've got kind of a difficult situation here, and Harry, you're not going to be able to do this. There is no cure for vampirism. I like Susan, too, but it can't be done. You think people haven't looked for a cure before now?" "I haven't looked for one before now," I said, "and I've had a couple of ideas I want to look at."
"Aye, Captain Ahab, ar, har, har, har. We'll get that white devil, sir."
"Damn right we will. But I've got something else to do first." Bob's eyelids brightened.
"You mean something other than hopeless, pointless vampire research? I'm already interested. Does it have to do with the reign of toads?"
I frowned, got out a pad of paper and a pencil, and started scratching things down. Sometimes that helped me sort things out. "Maybe. It's a murder investigation."
"Gotcha.
Who's the corpse?
Artist, Ronald Rule.
Bob's eyelights burned down to twin points.
Ah. Who's asking you to find the killer?
We don't know he was killed. Cops say it was an accident.
But you think differently.
I shook my head.
I don't know a thing about it, but Mab says he was killed. She wants me to find the killer and prove that it wasn't her.
Bob fell into a shocked silence for nearly a minute long. My pen scratched on the paper until Bob blurted,
Mab? The Mab, Harry?
Yeah.
Queen of Air and Darkness? That Mab?
Yeah,
I said, impatient.
And she's your client?
Yes, Bob.
Here's where I ask you why you don't spend your time doing something safer and more boring, like maybe administering suppositories to rabid gorillas.
I live for challenge, I said.
Oh, you don't, as the case may be,
Bob said brightly.
Harry, if I've told you once, I've told you a thousand times, you don't get tangled up with the she. It's always more complicated than you thought it would be.
Thanks for the advice, Skull Boy. It wasn't like I had a choice. Leah sold her my debt.
Then you should have traded her something for your freedom, Bob said.
You know, stolen an extra baby or something and given it to her.
Stolen a baby? I'm in enough trouble already.
Well, if you weren't such a goody-two-shoes all the time, I pushed at the bridge of my nose with my thumb. This was going to be one of those conversations that gave me a headache, I could tell already.
Look, Bob, can we stick to the subject, please? Time is important, so let's get to work. I need to know why Rule would have been knocked off.
Gee whiz, Harry, Bob said. Maybe it was because he was the summer night.
My pencil fell out of my fingers and rolled on the table.
Whoa, I said. Are you sure?
What do you think?
Bob replied, somehow putting a sneer into the words.
I said, this means trouble. It means that things with the she are more complicated than you thought.
Gee, if only someone had warned you at some point not to be an idiot and go making deals.
I gave the skull a sour look and recovered my pencil.
How much trouble am I in?
A lot, Bob said. The knights are entrusted with power by the she courts. They're tough.
I don't know much about them, I confessed. They're some kind of representatives of the fairies, right?
Don't call them that to their faces, Harry. They don't like it any more than you like being called an ape.
Just tell me what I'm dealing with.
Bob's eyelights narrowed until they were almost out, then brightened again after a moment as the skull began to speak. A she knight is mortal, Bob said. A champion of one of the she courts. He gets powers in line with his court, and he's the only one who's allowed to act in affairs not directly related to the she.
Meaning?
Meaning that if one of the queens wants an outsider dead, her knight is the trigger man.
I frowned.
Hang on a minute. You mean that the queens can't personally gun down anyone who isn't in their court?
Not unless the target does something stupid like make an open-ended bargain without even trying to trade a baby for...
Off topic, Bob! Do I, or don't I, have to worry about getting killed this time around?
Of course you do, Bob said in a cheerful tone. It just means that the queen isn't allowed to actually personally end your life.
They could, however, trick you into walking into quicksand and watch you drown, turn you into a stag and set the hounds after you, bind you into an enchanted sleep for a few hundred years, that kind of thing.
I guess it was too good to be true.
But my point is that if Rule was the summer knight, Mab couldn't have killed him, right? So why should she be under suspicion?
Because she could have done it indirectly. And Harry, odds are that the she don't really care about Rule's murder. Knights come and go like paper cups. I guess that they were upset about something else. The only thing they really care about.
Power, I guess.
See, you can use your brain when you want to.
I shook my head. Mab said something had been taken, and that I'd know what it was, I muttered.
I guess that's it.
How much power are we talking about?
A knight of the she is no pushover, Harry, Bob said, his tone earnest.
So we're talking about a lot of magic going AWOL. Grand Theft Mojo, I drummed my pen on the table.
Where does the power come from originally?
The queens,
I frowned.
Tell me if I'm off track here. It comes from the queens. It's part of them, right? If a knight dies, the power should snap back to the queen like it was a rubber band.
Exactly.
But this time it didn't. So the summer queen... is missing a load of power. She's been weakened.
If everything you've told me is true, yes, Bob said. There's no more balance between summer and winter. Hell, that could explain the toads. That's a serious play of forces, isn't it?
Bob rolled his eyelids.
The turning of the seasons? Duh, Harry. The Shi are closer to the mortal world than any other beings of the Never Never. Summer's had a slight edge for a while now, but it looks like they've lost it. And here I thought global warming was due to cow farts. I shook my head. So Titania lost a bunch of juice, and naturally suspicion falls on her archenemy, Mab.
Yeah, it is a kind of archenemy-ish thing to do, you have to admit.
I guess, I frowned down at my notes. Bob, what happens if this imbalance between the courts continues?
Bad things, Bob said. It will mess around with weather patterns, cause aberrant behavior in plants and animals, and sooner or later the she-courts will go to war with one another.
Why?
Because, Harry, when the balance is destroyed, the only thing the queens can do is to blow everything to flinders and let it settle out into a natural distribution again.
What does that mean to me?
I asked.
It depends on who has the edge when everything is settled, Bob said. A war could start the next ice age, or set off an era of rampant growth.
Well, that last one didn't sound so bad.
No, not if you're an Ebola virus. You'll have a lot of friends.
Oh, bad then.
Yeah, Bob said. Keep in mind that this is theory, though. I've never seen it happen. I haven't existed that long. But it's something the queens will want to avoid, if they can.
Which explains Mab's interest in this, if she didn't do it.
Even if she did, Bob corrected me. Did she ever actually tell you she was innocent?
I mulled it over for a moment.
No, I said finally. She twisted things around a lot.
So it's possible that she did do it, or had it done, at any rate.
Right, I said. So, to find out if it was one of the queens, we'll need to find her hitter. How tough would it be to kill one of these knights?
A flight of stairs wouldn't do it. A couple of flights of stairs wouldn't do it. Maybe if he went on an elevator ride with you.
Very funny, I frowned, drumming my pencil on the table. So it would have taken a little something extra to take out Rule. Who could manage it?
Regular folk could do it, but they wouldn't be able to do it without burning buildings and smoking craters and so on.
To kill him so that it looked like an accident? Maybe another knight could. Among the Shi, it was either the Winter Knight or one of the queens. Could a wizard do it?
That goes without saying. But you'd have to be a pretty brawny wizard, have plenty of preparation and a good channel to him. Even then, smoking craters would be easier than an accident.
The wizards have all been in duck and cover mode lately, and there are too many of them to make a practical suspect pool. Let's assume it was probably internal fairy stuff. That cuts it down to three suspects.
Three?
The three people who could have managed it. Summer Queen, Winter Knight. 1, 2, 3.
Hetty, I said it could have been one of the queens.
I blinked up at the skull.
There are more than two?
Yeah, technically there are three.
Three?
In each court.
Three queens in each court? Six? That's just silly.
No, not if you think about it. Each court has three queens. The queen who was, the queen who is, and the queen who is to come.
Great. Which one does the knight work for?
All of them. It's kind of a group thing. He has different duties to each queen.
I felt the headache start at the base of my neck and creep toward the crown of my head.
Okay, Bob, I need to know about these queens.
Which ones? The ones who are, who were, or who are to come?
I stared at the skull for a second, while the headache settled comfortably in.
There's got to be a simpler parlance than that.
That's so typical. You won't steal a baby, but you're too lazy to conjugate.
Hey, I said, my sex life has nothing to do with... Conjugate, Harry, conjugate!
Oh, why do I even bother? The queen is just the queen. Queen Titania. Queen Mab. The queen who was is called the mother. The queen who is to come is known as the lady. Right now, the winter lady is Mav. The summer lady is Aurora.
Lady, queen, mother. Gotcha.
I got a pencil and wrote it down just to help me keep it straight, including the names. So, six people who might have managed it.
Plus the winter knight, Bob said. In theory.
Right, I said. Seven. I wrote down the titles, then tapped the notebook thoughtfully and said,
Eight.
Eight? Bob asked. I took a deep breath and said,
Elaine's alive.
She's on the investigation for Summer.
Wow, Bob said. Wow, and I told you so. I know, I know. You think she might have gacked Rule?
No, I said, but I never saw it coming when she and Justin came after me, either. I only need to think about if she had the means to do it. I mean, if you think it would have been tough for me, maybe she wasn't capable of taking down Rule. I was always a lot stronger than her.
Yeah, Bob said, but she was better than you. She had a lot going for her that you didn't. Grace, style, elegance, breasts.
I rolled my eyes. So she's on the list until I find some reason she shouldn't be.
How jaded and logical of you, Harry.
I'm almost proud. I turned to the folder Mab had given me and went through the newspaper clippings inside. Any idea who the Winter Knight is?
Nope, sorry, Bob said. My contacts on the Winter side are kind of sketchy.
Okay, then. I sighed and picked up the notebook. I know what I need to do. This should be good, Bob said dryly.
Bite me. I have to find out more about Rule.
Who was close to him? Maybe someone saw something. If the police assumed it was an accident, I doubt there was an investigation.
Bob nodded, somehow managing to look thoughtful. So, are you going to take an ad out in the paper, or what?
I went around the lab and started snuffing candles. I thought I'd try a little breaking and entering. Then I'll go to his funeral, see who shows.
Gosh, can I do fun things like you when I grow up?
I snorted and turned to the stepladder, taking my last lit candle with me.
Hetty, Bob said just before I left.
I stopped and looked back at him.
For what it's worth,
be careful.
If I hadn't known any better, I'd have said Bob the Skull was almost shaking.
You're an idiot about women, and you have no idea what Mab is capable of. I looked at him for a moment, his orange eyes, the only light in the dimness of my frenetically neat lab. It sent a little shiver through me. Then I clomped back up the stepladder and went out to burrow trouble.
Chapter 11. I made a couple of phone calls, slapped a few things into a nylon backpack, and sallied forth to break into Ronald Rule's apartment. Rule had lived at the south edge of the Loop, in a building that looked like it had once been a theater. The lobby yawned up to a high ceiling and was spacious and pretty enough, but it left me looking for velvet ropes and listening for a disorganized squawking of an orchestra warming up its instruments. I walked in wearing a hat with a FTD logo and carrying a long white flower box under one arm. I nodded to an aging security guard at the desk and went on past him to the stairs, my steps purposeful. You'd be surprised how far a hat, a box, and a confident stride can get you. I took the stairs up to Rule's apartment on the third floor. I went up them slowly, my wizard senses open, on the lookout for any energies that might yet be lingering around the site of the old man's death. I paused for a moment over the spot where Rule's body had been found, to be sure that there was nothing. If a lot of magic had been put to use in Rule's murder, someone had covered its tracks impressively. I went the rest of the way up to the third floor, but it wasn't until I opened the door to the third floor hallway that my instincts warned me that I was not alone. I froze, with the door from the stairway only half open, and listened. Listening isn't particularly hard. I'm not even sure it's all that magical. I can't explain it well, other than to say I'm able to block out everything but what I hear and pick up things I would normally miss. It's a skill that not many people have these days, and one that has been useful to me more than once. This time, I was able to listen to a half-whispered basso curse and a rustle of papers from somewhere down the hall. I opened the flower box and drew out my blasting rod, then checked my shield bracelet. All in all, in close quarters like this, I would have preferred a gun to my blasting rod, but I'll have a hell of a time explaining it to the security or to the police if they caught me snooping around a dead man's apartment. I tightened my grip on the rod and slid quietly down the hall, hoping I wouldn't need to use it. Believe it or not, my first instinct isn't always to set things on fire. The door to Rule's apartment stood half open, and its pale wood glared where it had been freshly splintered. My heart sped up. It looked like someone had beaten me to Rule's place. It meant that I must be on the right track. It also meant that whoever it was would probably not be thrilled to see me. I crept to the door and peered inside. What I could see of the apartment could have been imported from 429B Baker Street. Dark woods, fancy scroll work, and patches of cloth busier than the makeup girl at a Kiss concert filled every available inch of space with Victorian splendor. Or rather, it once had. Now the place looked wrecked. A sideboard stood denuded of